So, purpose of this panel, as described to me by Peggy, was to have a nerd fest of sorts, to really talk about comics. So to that end, with some help from my comics compadres, Frank Santoro and Tim Hodler, we came up with a bunch of questions for Dan that we thought would sort of burrow deep into the essence of comicdom. So, let's begin.
Without further ado,
Dan, Al Capp or Ham Fisher?
You know, I've always kind of been an Al Capp man, actually. I've always found Al Capp to be funny. I never quite understood the hatred for him, especially by people nowadays who weren't sort of, you know, a party to the whole thing where he, you know, his whole anti-hippie, angry old man thing. I actually enjoy that. I like anti-hippie, angry old men. And I don't know, I like the idea of this bitter old one-legged guy who's you know, the most successful cartoonist in the world, and then he's not quite that, and he's angry at the world. I mean, that's a great thing. So I'm with Al.
Wayne Boring or Kurt Swan?
Oh, that's a tough one. I like them both. To me, Kurt Swan draws... Should we even explain who these people are, or should we just assume that our audience is a literate comic audience?
We'll just assume.
At the Alternative Press Expo.
We'll assume. Wayne Boring and Kurt Swan both drew Superman.
In the 50s.
In the 50s and 60s.
To me, Kurt Swan, as inked by George Klein, is the most uninflected comic art there is. Like, to me, it's the closest to looking like it has no style of any art there is, which is a big plus in my book. I mean, I think we're always trying to kind of get away from style and to make things look like this sort of pure iconography with no little tweaks in any direction. And to me, Kurt Swan, George Klein, Superman has that, where there's a sort of a specificity to it, and yet there's nothing, he's never off about anything. Like, the eyeballs are always lining up, and I don't know, there's something about it. But Wayne Boring is just pretty awesome. I mean, just that, he's just kind of the wrong guy to draw Superman. Like, Superman looks like he's like a big Italian thug. You know, Kurt Swan kind of captured, to me, the great Superman, of course, is George Reeves in the Superman TV show, where he's kind of a paunchy dad, and that's not at all what Wayne Boring is. He's more of a thug.
Gil Kane or Vern Hogarth for comic book artists who are also autodidacts.
Yeah.
And talked a lot.
I was actually, the very first panel I was ever on many, many years ago was me, Robert Crumb, Gilbert Hernandez, Peter Begg, and Vern Hogarth. And Hogarth was supposed to do a little preamble and sort of introduce, like, here's the young generation of cartoonists or something. And he talked for almost an hour about how we were the worst artists who ever lived. He really said, like, you have no point of view, you're not coming from any particular school, your work is just worthless. And he kept blathering on, and it was an audience, of course, of, like, young hipster kids who wanted to see Robert Crumb and were not hearing Crumb say a word because Hogarth was rambling on. And people started yelling out, like, shut up, old man! And finally, Crumb, I was sitting next to Crumb, it was the first day I'd ever met him. And Crumb just slowly leaned back in his chair and then fell over, did like a pratfall. And Hogarth didn't miss a beat, just kept on going about this. And I literally did not say a word in the entire panel. It was a proud achievement. But that being said, yeah, Hogarth for sure. Gil Kane's actually kind of a smart, erudite, very lovable old man who always called everybody my boy whenever he'd see it. Oh, my boy. And, you know, he seemed like a John Updike, or like a John Cheever character, actually, like a, you know, sort of a suburban
Striver.
And Hogarth, was the real thing. He was, I remember him talking about some rival of his from the early days, you know, who he had had a feud with in like the 30s, and this was in the 90s, and he said, "I just want that bastard to die so I can piss on his grave." Good for you. God bless you.
Really held on to it.
I remember Hogarth died at a comic convention in France, and it was before this other guy had died, and I remember thinking like, "Ah, I gotta pick an older enemy so I can piss on his grave."
We'll get to that later.
From Hogarth.
Now, I know you have a horse in this race, but mad or cracked?
Oh, come on, that's not fair.
It's fair!
Okay, well, I'm not going to go on record as saying, like, well, cracked is better than that. But for a brief moment there in 1985, under the editorship of Mort Todd, cracked was slightly better than mad, because they were able to get Don Martin. And they still had John Severin, who was, for some reason, doing the amazing pen work every month. He was the most ill-suited artist ever for humor comics. I mean, he was actually a pretty funny guy in person, but...
Severin was?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, he was a very, very funny guy, but on the page, he's so deadly unfunny, which sort of made it funny on a meta level, I guess. But, you know... I'm not going to compare like the Kurtzman Mad to Cracked or anything, but you know I have a soft spot for Cracked. I used to defend Cracked as a kid. Like, it's not that bad.
I preferred Cracked as a kid.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I didn't understand.
Did you read it in the 80s back when Mort Todd was?
I read it when you were drawing for it.
When I used to do, we used to do parodies of TV shows that we would watch. Like on VHS, like Ben Casey, right. Literally shows that nobody knew, like especially in 1980, like shows that hadn't been on in 30 years. We did a parody of the TV show The Millionaire, which was only on in the 50s, never rerun, expecting, you know, the publisher to say, like, we really don't want you to do that, but they never read it, they never noticed. It's great.
You had that much free reign at Cracked?
Apparently so.
You were what, in your early 20s?
Yeah, early 20s. I remember I did a parody of Dick Tracy, you know, but like the 50s Dick Tracy.
Right.
And they, you know, they were fine with it.
Continuing in that vein, Don Martin or Al Jaffe?
You know, I like Al Jaffe, but... I have an Al Jaffe story. When I first moved to New York, as a kid, my dream was to go to that address, Mad Magazine's address, which was, I can't remember, like 620 Madison Avenue, you know, and I just imagined, like, that was the nexus of all greatness in the world. And so when I was 18, I went to New York for the first time, and I took the subway and went to that address. And I was sort of walking around there, and I see this guy, and I thought, that guy has got to be Al Jaffe. He looked exactly the way he drew himself. And I actually went up and said, "Are you Al Jaffe?" And he did this whole, like, "Well, how would you know?" You know, and said, "Well, you look just like the way you draw yourself." And he signed a little autograph. And so, you know, I have a soft spot for Al Jaffe. But Don Martin is really an unsung genius, I think. I mean, it's, you know, when I was 10, there could be nothing funnier than a Don Martin cartoon. I think that his book, The Adventures of Captain Klutz, you should do that. You should reprint that.
That's a good idea.
Masterpiece. It's a graphic novel. I mean, none of that appeared in Mad.
Really?
It's a long story. Yeah.
I'm writing that down.
There's no breaks in it. I mean, it's a one long story in a book.
What else did you like about Don Martin? Nobody talks about Don Martin anymore.
I like that he would utterly contrive a joke. Like, the jokes weren't based on a pun of anything that exists in the world. It's like he would make up a situation and then make a joke out of that. And it was like he was starting from nothing and contriving a joke out of that. Like, I can't even put it into words, but it was just like the situations were so absurd, they had no basis in reality, really. They weren't playing off of something like, "Oh yeah, that would happen to me." It was totally his own crazy creation, and was like he was going, you know, a normal joke would go like A, B, you know, D, like you skip a step, but his were like starting with G, and it would be like G, X, you know, double V, or so. It was just a totally weird rhythm.
And did you like the drawing as well?
Yeah.
The thin line?
You know, it doesn't hold up as much for me. Now it looks a little like he's trying to be funny, but as a kid it really worked.
Okay.
He was an interesting guy, too.
Did you meet him?
I got to meet him at a cracked dinner one time. They had a big cracked dinner.
There were cracked dinners.
There was one.
One.
There was one. One. Before yes. Martin Todd got fired, he would throw away huge amounts of money on stuff like that. I just remember Don Martin's wife was very much the boss of the outfit there. She was, you know, he didn't say much.
He was quiet?
Yeah, Norma was doing all the talking.
Eric Stanton or Steve Ditko? Or Stanton Inc. Ditko?
Yeah, but there's a mystery
as to... I'll let you explain.
Eric Stanton was in the 50s, drew bondage illustrations, like stuff that seems so impossibly dirty nowadays. Like you cannot believe this existed in the 50s. You think like you would be in the gas chamber if you were caught buying this in the 50s. And he apparently shared a studio with this guy, Steve Ditko, who was the creator of Spider-Man, and et cetera, and still alive and still living above a strip club on Times Square, as far as I know.
It is on 43rd Street, I think.
I'll tell you, I feel like I'm the oldest man in the world. Like, well, I actually met Steve Ditko one time, which is impossible to do. He's notoriously... like you can't meet him. He's never done an interview and doesn't make appearances. But when I moved to New York, 1979, I looked in the phone book in the white pages, and I'll look up Steve Ditko. There it is. It's a Steve Ditko artist, and it has his address and phone number, Mr. Recluse. So I thought, oh, I'll go to his address, and it was literally above like the sleaziest like peep show porn theater in New York called Show World Center. And so there's like a bank of apartments above this place. And so I go to the doorman and I'm looking at the register and I said, does Steve Ditko live here? And the doorman goes, never heard of him. And I look, hey, there's his name. And the doorman said, oh, well, you want to go up? And I'm, okay. And, you know, this is pre-9/11. And so I go up and I'm like, well, what am I going to do? You know, like a totally nervous, zit-covered 18-year-old. So I go to his door and I knock on the door, and he opens it to the chain's length, you know, the perfect like. And I look behind him and I see all these like cool drawings on the wall and stuff. And he actually said, "What do yous want?" And like I'd read that for a year. I was always like, "Yous, what is that?" I'd read that in a Jack Kirby comic. They'd say "yous," and I had no idea what that was. And then when he said it, I thought, oh. Yeah, what he is one. And I said, gosh, are you Mr. Ditko, the comic artist? Slam! And that was it. That was my big meeting. So.
It's stayed with you ever since.
It was, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. So I can't, those two are so interlocked, I can't separate them.
Wally Wood or Jack Kirby?
Ouch.
I know.
That's harsh.
Yeah. If you had to choose.
I can't. I won't. But as a character, as a person, Wally Wood to me is like the romantic ideal of a cartoonist, because he's just such a bitter failure. Like he's such a, you know, his career is so filled with these fanboy highs and then the dismal lows that can come out of that, and you know, just the way he lived and died is so film noirishly romantic. I can't find a better exemplar of that type of cartoonist. But you know, Kirby, I actually don't even really like to read Kirby's comics. I find like all the DC stuff that sort of everybody now thinks is his best stuff, I find it really hard to read. But just his drawings, just like every panel is cool. one Stan Lee wrote the best.
Wally Wood is the tragic figure. I wanted to ask you about that a little bit more, actually. Do you think of that as actually being like a romantic, tragic ideal, or is that, has that changed over the years? Or because, you know, you have a family and things
are
relatively good.
Well, it's not like I want to be like living like Wally Wood, but there's this real sense that that's where you very likely could end up if you keep drawing comics.
Why?
It seems to be the case for a lot of artists.
Yeah,
and somebody like Wood, who was so sort of anti-commercial, you know, he was very prickly, very hard to deal with. You know, art directors always hated him, publishers hated him. But he would put everything into the page. You know, he really, really wanted to, like, wow his 10 fans that would write to him. You know, that was before you had any idea how many people were actually reading this stuff. And just that sort of that love and dedication mixed with the sort of the neuropathic illness that causes you to sit at the board like that and focus on that stuff, there's something that's very primal in his example. You know, it's sort of the quintessential example of how that can go wrong. So it's a cautionary tale to some degree, but you know, I love everything he did. I love, you know, even all the silly wizard stuff and all that.
Do you like the sort of 70s porn stuff?
You gotta love it.
Yeah.
You gotta embrace it.
Yes.
It's so hopelessly sad and crude, and yet it's...
There's something in there. There's a grace to it.
It looks a bit like some of the stuff you've published. It's got a little bit of that.
Hey.
Of that, like, you know, that sort of devil may care, like, I don't care quality.
Right.
Like, of, wow, I can't believe somebody's drawing this, you know.
Right. I wanted to ask you also, you talked a little bit about drawing and iconography, and I mean, your early stuff was very heavily rendered, and you know, you were putting a lot of lines on the page, and now it's loosened up and gotten more minimal, and I wondered, sort of, is that actually kind of a sort of de facto philosophical stance, sort of moving more towards iconography, or is it that you prefer drawing that way, or how's that evolved?
I think that was my goal early on. I even remember being in high school, and I remember one of the very few things an art teacher said to me that was valuable was maybe Charles Schulz actually, and they're saying, you know, a guy like this can draw really well, he can draw realistically and all the shadows and all that stuff, but then he knows how to take all that stuff away and become simpler. And I really wanted to draw simply, but I thought I needed to learn to do the sort of the full thing before I could then simplify. And when I first started doing comics professionally, I was really insecure, you know. It's a weird feeling to be working in obscurity for all these years, and all of a sudden your stuff is out there and people are seeing it. And so I was really like trying to put as much detail and line work and stuff into it, almost as a way to distract from my insecurity with the drawing. And I think for a while I would look at that stuff and it really bothered me. But now I look back and I think it's got a really interesting kind of crude push-pull between this real kind of slick comic style and this kind of really struggling, crude desire to get this very specific kind of tortured look to it. And you know, after a while I was much more comfortable not only with drawing, but with having the work seen. And really, I always wanted to do work that was the most readable, the most... you know, that somebody will start looking at the page, and the next thing they know, they're immersed in the narrative, and they're lost in it, and they're forgetting they're reading a comic until I want them to remember they're reading a comic, in which case I'd use some kind of an image that would kind of bring them out of that. But I find the sort of the more pared down, kind of simpler style it works for that much more fluidly, I think.
And it works in a really interesting way in Wilson, actually. I was thinking about this the other day, that even though there's sort of glimmers, because Wilson, each page is drawn in a slightly different cartoon style, but you can't quite pinpoint it. It's just little glimmers here and there, but you've sort of unified it all with your line, I guess. I mean, is that something that you has that just evolved naturally, that line quality and the kind of open-endedness of it? And do you draw a lot outside of comics these days?
I do a lot of little practice drawings.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do anything like, you know, Chris Ware or Robert Crumb, where it's this kind of presentation drawing in a booklet. I have a few sketches I wouldn't mind somebody seeing, but the 99% of them will never be seen because they're not. That's not the purpose. I don't want to have that pressure on them. I try to draw as quickly as I can when I'm doing that stuff, so the actual drawing stays spontaneous. I can remember I used to sit in on Art Spiegelman's class when he taught at the SVA in New York, and he had this whole thing that he had learned from Harvey Kurtzman about getting your layouts perfect. And it was like you start out with like a yellow marker and you do a preliminary sketch, and then you get tracing paper and you go over that with an orange marker, then you do a red marker, then you do a green, then blue, then finally black, and you've got it all perfect. And so I thought, okay, you know, that's how you got to do it. And I did that for like one story, and I just hated it. I hated like the final artwork so much. I was so burned out on it. And I thought it's better to just sit down and do it the first time. You can't belabor it. And that's like one of the big troubles with comics. That's why you can't redraw things, because it's like you've spent all your energy and you can't go back to it. So you really got to kind of get it right the first time.
Speaking of early years, just wondered, I know, at least I think there's a story that you have a drawing by Crumb above your drawing board, where he's pointing down at you saying...
It's not a play, it's like in my kitchen, actually.
It's in your kitchen. Crumb reminding you that he was the king and you were the young buck or something like that.
It was, I had like an art show in Amsterdam, and I walked into the gallery one day and I saw Crumb. He was in town with the Cheap Suit Serenaders, and I saw him hunched over like a book in the back of the art show. And then later I looked in the book and he had done this masterpiece drawing of him saying like, "Yeah, you think you're so great, Clausel? I'm still the king, and don't you forget it." Fucking little punk. So
are you competitive these days? I mean, do you ever look at people coming up that way?
I try not. I don't feel competitive with younger cartoonists, because it's like it's such a struggle to just get through the first like 5 or 10 years. It's
right.
I don't know. I try to be magnanimous about all that. But I find I'm competitive with like old dead guys a lot. You know, like
really?
Johnny Craig and guys like, you know, it's like I gotta ink a better panel than Johnny Craig. You know, I set my sights low on that stuff.
Johnny Craig.
Johnny Craig.
Hey, Johnny Craig's pretty high.
Johnny Craig's pretty good.
Yeah. And who was supportive then for you when you were coming up? Crumb was joking
in the
basically.
Industry?
Yeah.
I mean, Crumb was always a little weird to me. Like the first time I talked to Crumb, he advised me, he's like, "Whatever you do, don't draw comics for very long, you know, draw for like 4 or 5 years and then take like 5 or 10 years off and do like pottery or something." I wish I had done that. And I thought like, "Oh, that's great advice." And then I mentioned that to Zweigoff, and he was like, "He was just trying to get you up here, like, so you wouldn't draw comics." He's very, very competitive, I guess. But I don't know, I didn't have a whole lot of support when I was
really?
No, not really.
I mean, who were your... Well, I guess Rick Altergott was a peer.
Yeah, Rick Altergott was like my best friend in college. We were supportive of each other, but in terms of like older guys, the Hernandez brothers, they were there before I was, you know, and they were, they could have been really like, who's this new guy trying to do a Fantagraphics book, but they were really super nice to me, and I think they were happy to have somebody else to talk to, really.
Right.
Back then,
at conventions.
Yeah, back then at conventions, you would really, you know, get trapped in a room with, Richard and Wendy Pini or somebody like that.
Yeah, those were very different days.
Very, very different days. Very different.
Was there anything good about that kind of weird mix back then? Of sort of, I think you told me you barely missed Wally Wood at a convention once or something.
I saw him from a distance.
Yeah. but I mean, nowadays these things, these worlds don't really mix so much.
No, no. There was something kind of great that, like, it used to be if you went to the San Diego convention, you were with every one of the guests. Like, if you were sort of an artist guest, you'd find yourself at a dinner with Ray Harryhausen on one side and some Marvel guy on the other. You know, just like this table of like 15 guys. Like, I remember hanging out with Adam West at a convention. And now it would, you know, now you say you're going to the San Diego convention and somebody will say, you know, hey, did you run into so-and-so? And that's like saying, like, oh, I'm going to go to New York this weekend. It's like, oh, did you see Mayor Bloomberg while you were there? You know, it's inconceivable. But so it was kind of fun to, you'd be like sort of trapped together and you'd kind of bond with these people you never thought you'd like. And then you'd have this weird experience of, like, over the years that bond would erode until you've felt again like you didn't know them. Like, it was a very weird feeling. Like, you'd see them 5 years later and you'd reintroduce yourself to them and it's like you had no recollection of spending this time together and stuff. It was an odd thing. But I can't say I really miss it. You know, I'm glad I lived through it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very different world for, I mean, you're talking about cartoonists coming up now. It's an entirely different ball game, it seems
totally.
Like. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you also about the soundtracks that you occasionally, I mean, for like A Velvet Glove, you had Tim Hensley do
yeah.
a soundtrack. What was that? Do you ever get that inclination anymore to commission soundtracks for the comics?
Well, was it the thing with that was Tim Hensley, who's a great cartoonist and an equally great musician, he was in a band called Victor Banana, and he sent me his tape, and I did his album cover. And after that, I said, you know, so what are you working on? And he's, oh, you know, oh, I don't really have a project now. And I thought, like, I really want to hear more of his songs. And so I came up with this weird idea for him to do these Velvet Glove songs. And he, you know, he got right down to work and started writing. He wrote dozens of them that were never on the record that are all, every one of them is great. And he somehow scraped together the money to put that out himself, and I told him I would sign every single one of those so we could sell them, and now they go for a fortune, actually. But it was really just to get him to do some more songs. That was my only goal. And I thought his stuff, it was so cool, I wanted to link myself to him in some way, because he was such a great musician.
And you used to do a ton of record covers for a while there, or it felt like a ton.
It was, yeah, for a couple of years, back in the early 90s, in the grunge era.
Who was the worst band you were associated with? What was the bottom of the barrel?
I've said this and nobody believes me, but I never listened to almost all of those records at any point, because I knew it would. It just wasn't my kind of thing. But when I was a young kid, the main thing I ever wanted to do was an album cover. I had all those Jack Davis albums, you know, where just put tons of detail into those things, and that to me, it was just the perfect canvas. You know, it's just the perfect size to draw things and print it on nice coated stock and everything. And so I was sort of willing to do anything that came along. And so, you know, I didn't. To this day, I couldn't tell you, you know, what the Super Suckers sound like.
Me neither.
I'm sure I'm missing a lot.
Yeah. And to that point, I mean, I think a lot of people like myself learned about those record covers in the back of 8-Ball, or you'd see ads and things like that, or learned about other things in the back of 8-Ball. Because you used to kind of have it almost felt like a mini flea market in the pages of 8-Ball.
I mean, it was sort of the pre-internet nexus for a certain crowd, and it felt like a responsibility. You know,
really?
I felt like a bit of a...
Because you had an audience?
Yeah, I felt like there were certain people who were reaching out to me to meet other people who read 8-Ball, and I sort of felt like I was the proprietor of this little community, and I used to, you know, I would write back to everybody, and I would tell people about each other that I thought would get along. Huh. You know, I think I've introduced several couples in comics. I think I introduced Altergott to his wife, and as I recall, Johnny Ryan's wife wrote to me and asked me, like, there's this guy, Johnny Ryan, what's he like? He's a dreamboat. You're going to love him. send me cool stuff, and they had no way to tell anybody about it, so I would give a little plug in there and stuff like that. And as soon as, you know, the internet started to grow and that kind of thing became commonplace, that completely took over for it, and there was no necessity for it anymore. But in the pre-internet days, that was all we had, you know, that kind of a thing. And I would buy Hate or Yummy for any of those comics, and the first thing I would do was read the letters page.
Yeah.
It had, you know, it was sort of that way of finding a community at that time. And I felt like we knew every fan by name back then, you know. We would talk about the fans like, you know, they would have no idea we would pay any attention to who they were, but of course we were as obsessed with them as they were with us, because it's like, wow, somebody's, you know, this guy's reading all our comics. We knew them all.
So it was fun, actually.
It really brought people out of the woodwork, because now it's very easy to know about all this stuff.
Yeah.
And at the time, you really had to make some effort to know about 8-Ball or Hate or anything. You had to be part of a weird scene to know about that stuff, and it was so hard to explain to somebody what you were doing.
Right.
It was impossibly hard.
Now?
Now, you know, I could say to like my 80-year-old aunt, like, oh, I did a graphic novel, and oh, like Persepolis? Oh, that's right. It's a different world.
Do you think, I mean, I've wondered about this for you and the Hernandez brothers and Pete Bagg, like, as you've progressed for, you know, 25, 30 years, has sort of the growing audience changed your work? Do you think it's impacted your work? Has it changed the way you think about it? I mean, because you don't have to be a custodian of this community anymore. You can kind of just be an artist.
No, I've left all that behind, certainly. And I have much, much less connection to the audience than I did back then.
Really?
Yeah. Because I know if I were to do like an online kind of thing, I'm just the kind of person who obsessively has to write back to everybody. And so I would just be all day writing back, sorry, no, I can't do your pinup for your charity auction. You know, and it would be such an endless drain. I would never do any work. And so I've made a point to not do that. But back in the 8-Ball days, I would go to the mailbox every 3 or 4 days, and there would be like 50 letters and maybe packages, and I mean, it was really cool. It was really, it had that feeling of like Christmas every day.
Yeah.
And it was all, you know, every package was always filled with like a little handmade thing, and there was always glitter, and it would always get all over the apartment. Everybody was in those horrible Jiffy mailers that would get the dust causes cancer all over your apartment.
Yeah.
But, you know, but it was great. It was, you never knew what you were going to get. And
right.
A lot of it was really angry. I used to inspire just utter hatred from certain people. I remember getting one of my comics torn up in like tiny little pieces, and then they mailed it to me. Thank you.
I needed that.
Thanks for your vote of confidence.
And the inevitable questions that I have are things like, is Death Ray ever coming back into print? I mean, are you working?
It is
towards...
actually. It's
oh,
worked.
It is.
Plans, but it's we're very close to being able to announce these plans, but not. I can't do it yet.
Okay.
But
and what so. What about the early work like Lloyd Llewellyn? And is that ever going to come back?
You know, it could. I don't know. I sort of feel like I need to have like 12 books in print before I could have Lloyd Llewellyn be like a 12th of my body of work. You know, I don't want anybody to pick that up and go, oh man, that wasn't really what I was expecting. You know, I want it to, it would have to be packaged in a way that it's like the archival juvenilia of this artist. But I think, you know, at some point I'd like to do like the complete 8-Ball with all the letters pages and the cover and all that stuff, and do it. I'd love to do it just like one of those Russ Cochran Mad, you know, EC things. Like,
giant, oversized, like black and
really,
red hardcover.
Really, like the most nerdishly, like I'd get like Max Allen Collins to write the like Ron Goulart on the case.
Yeah.
That would be
cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Those books were actually, they're pretty wonderful. They hold up. Those, I don't know if you guys know, these Russ Cochran slipcased editions of EC and Little Lulu.
Yeah.
All that stuff really, That must have impacted you a lot, even the format.
It was mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I was actually just thinking, there was a book of EC horror comics that came out in the early 70s that Woody Gelman from Nostalgia Press. It was just like the EC horror comics of the 1950s. And I remember going to Crux and Brentano's bookstore in Chicago and reading this every week, and it was just so far beyond being able to afford it. It was like $25 or something, and I would read this every week, just, you know, read another story, and it's the stuff in there is, it's literally on the level of like a Saw movie, like of like the goriest movie you can imagine. And yet this is an era where like you couldn't say God in a movie, or you couldn't say like, you know, shoot, or, you know, I mean, it's unbelievable to think that the discrepancy between what was in those comics and what was in every other form of media. I mean, it just, literal like entrails being ripped open in every single story.
Big baseball with heads.
Do they do that? You know, it's inconceivable. Like you couldn't even, there's no way you could come up with anything nowadays that could ever be as far away from the mainstream as that.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. What could it be? I mean,
I don't know.
We look at that stuff's in the movies and on TV, you know. It's unbelievable.
So I want to ask you a last question before we take some questions. Baseball.
You're going to go with the Santoro theorem?
The Santoro theorem, which I actually don't understand well enough to explain.
Oh, but wait, perhaps you can. Frank Santoro.
Yes. Well, it's Wilson. Frank came up with a theory about Wilson that it's all baseball. And you...
He had some theory that it was... That was like, it was, his theory was quite elaborate.
Yes.
Very elaborate.
I have it here for people who would like to look at it later.
You should post it on a billboard for all to see.
Yes.
But it was something like, well, each strip in Wilson represented an inning of baseball.
9 innings, 70 pages, 8 pitches.
Oh yeah, each one was like a batter in an inning. So there was like 3 pages where, and he had this whole thing of how I was approaching the book like a pitcher trying to pitch a no-hitter in baseball, or trying to pitch a perfect game, where in baseball a pitcher would, you know, wants a batter to think he's going to throw a fastball and then he throws a curveball.
Right.
And so it was that, he was sort of trying to compare it to that kind of, the kind of game that would be pitched by a pitcher who is maybe like a Nolan Ryan, like an older guy who has to rely on his wits to get the pitches by the young bucks. And of course this hadn't actually occurred to me, but when I got his email, I realized I had been thinking a lot about baseball. I realized how much I think about baseball. I haven't followed baseball since 1978 was the last year. But up until then, I was obsessively, like, I knew every batting average on every player. I mean, I was completely obsessed.
So it was baseball and comics and records.
Yeah, and I had all this energy as a teenager, and so I'd draw in my room for like 2 hours, and then I'd go out in the alley behind my house and throw a tennis ball against the brick wall into like a little, drew like a strike zone, you know, this tiny little thing, and I would throw it into that like 300 times in a row, and then I'd go back inside. Like it was this weird, you know, neurological defect that caused me to do that. And I find that I often think in baseball terms, you know. I always think of what some cartoonist, what is their ranking in terms of, like, are they a major leaguer? Are they a sandlot player? Are they this and that? You know, and that kind of thing is just a filter by which I see everything. And the book Wilson was very much about my dad, and very influenced by my dad, who was a real baseball nut. And so I realized how much he had kind of inflicted his baseball thing onto me, and so there was something to this whole baseball thing, but it was absolutely unspoken in the story. There's a few tiny references to baseball, but I wrote to Santoro and said that he had, in some crazed, you know, comic book fever dream, had tapped into something that's so imperceptible that I I couldn't believe he somehow found it in some, you know, Jungian mindscape that exists beyond all of us. So it was a very odd thing to read his email. That seemed totally insane, and yet I felt like that he's probably exactly right.
Right.
This unconscious baseball game that I'm trying to pitch.
And is comics history a constant presence for you as you're working? Because it seems, particularly the last bunch of work, is very much engaging with the history and playing with it and subverting it. And you were just saying that, you know, you rank cartoonists in your head. And,
right.
I mean, how can you get away from it at all, do you feel like? Or is it just...
Well, I realized at a certain point that the thing that keeps me drawing comics... And the thing that has always moved me along is that comics history is really disappointing. It's really not. It's not the same as the history of novels, history of art, history of movies. The body of work is pretty spotty, you know.
Right.
And the things we imagine existed don't quite exist. You know, it's like we imagine that Alex Toth did amazing, like, film noir comics in the 50s that really worked and were like Howard Hawks movies. But he didn't do that. He never did a comic that you could even read. You know, and
that's true.
And it's terrible. I mean, and I say that with nothing but thinking he is one of the greatest geniuses of the 20th century, but he wasn't interested in telling nuanced or interesting stories. And so it's not like the career of a Hitchcock or a John Huston or somebody like that. It's a career of a really good cinematographer in a way, or a director that just didn't have any decent scripts to work with. And so I'm always trying to imagine this sort of history that combines the history of Hollywood and novels and comics into this thing that didn't exist, and I'm trying to sort of live in that history, you know, where there were Hitchcocks in comics who did these graphic novels per year that was a perfect visual psychological experience like that. And so it's like I have an imagined history more than a real history.
No, that's the funny thing about comics history is you go back in and you have to pick, oh, Johnny Craig's inking.
Right.
But you can't embrace an entire body of work.
It's very tough, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were guys who did amazing things, but there's not the big bulk of stuff that you have in movies, for example.
Yeah.
You know, where there's 50 comedy directors.
Do you still look for it? I mean, are you still sifting through the history?
Oh, sure. But, you know, at a certain point, you feel like I'm not going to find another Kirby or Toth or Ditko or any of those guys, you know. That would be known, you know, unless they did one comic out there, you know. There's a few guys who did one really good comic and that was it, you know. Maybe it's George Roussos. There's one of the guys who was like a Marvel colorist.
George Roussos.
And I found and he was always really sloppy and like, and I found one story he did that was like really just beautiful. Like he just killed himself on it.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, you know, what happened to this? And clearly it probably took him way too much time. He's like, nobody liked it. Forget it.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's that one.
You know? There's always that one.
Yeah.
It's just that it's only 8 pages.
Or that one, that Bob Powell colorama.
Oh, sure.
You know, that's like so far beyond anything else he ever did.
Yeah.
That's kind of all the things we think of as like the 50s in comics, all the weird stuff is kind of summed up in that story, and that's it. You know, it's what, 6 pages.
Yeah. The disappointing history of comics.
There we are. That's our title.
What time is it?
I think 15 minutes.
Any questions?
Do we have to step up to the mic? Is that how it works?
How does this work? I guess there's a mic.
Where's the...
Go ahead.
Speak up.
Please.
Okay. I was wondering if you find yourself psychologically influenced by the history of comics as a refuge for, like, Jews who couldn't get illustration work in the big magazines, and people who went to comics as sort of an other space outside of society.
Well, yeah, I mean, it certainly, I really enjoyed that about comics when I first started. You know, it was, it, nobody thought that was like a wise career move, and nobody thought it was like an artistically valid medium at that point. But I had a bunch of friends, and I knew a couple of other artists who we all sort of knew that there was a lot of potential there, and it felt like, oh, we get to do this thing, and nobody else is going to bother us about it because we have our own little space. So it did feel like that.
Yeah. Question about the writing process for David Boring.
You know, that one I did plan on. Often I just have kind of a rough plot skeleton of where it's going to go. And David Boring, I wanted to really write the whole thing before I sat down to work on it. And then as I was working on it, I got all these different ideas, and I wound up taking it in a whole new direction. But I really had a lot of stuff figured out that wasn't on the page. I had this theory that the more you know about a world, that stuff will come through in some way, whether you know it or not. It sort of seeps in unconsciously, and I'm not sure that's true. I was truly trying to see if anybody picked up on any of this stuff, and so I would get, like, if you look through that story, all the dates are actual dates, and I, like, made sure, like, the phases of the moon are accurate and stuff like that. You know, it was very, I wanted it to feel like somehow it was very real in a certain way, or hyper-real. But I actually don't remember a lot about, right, you know, sitting down and writing it. I just can, you know, I looked at my notebooks and I noticed all these crazy little notations. I actually got a date book for the years the story took place, and so I wrote down the events that happened on each day to David Boring. So I have, like, David Boring's date book, you know, 1998 to 2000. You know, I was playing with a lot of different genres in that. I didn't have it all methodically figured out. That stuff is all intuitive. You know, it's just got to sort of feel like the right moment. I did, going into it, I knew I was going to try to combine all these different kinds of unrelated, sort of unsympathetic to each other genres. So, I knew that was going to take place, but I didn't know when and where. You know, that I actually announced that wasn't going to be made at the 2006 San Diego Con. I'm going to squash this whole thing by announcing it at the convention, because anybody mentions any little thing they're going to do. This is about to say, this is a movie Michel Gondry and I were going to try to make that was this crazy science fiction novel that he owned the rights to, and he was trying to get made, and he brought me in to write it, and we tried to get it made, and it was basically like a $150 million art film, like a totally crazy art film, and there was no way to take what was in that book and make it commercial. We tried every possible idea we could come up with, and it just got less and less commercial, and so we just realized, until there's some kind of technology where we can do a $150 million film for $12 million, it won't be made. So I made this announcement, like, you know, that will not be made, it's never going to happen, no. And people want that movie to be made, so it will not die.
Go ahead.
Some of your recent characters, such as in Death Ray and Wilson, they seem to have been an internal life, whether you're protagonist and not doing anything wrong. And kind of heroes of your story, but they kind of fit, like, either verbally or through actions, very well, kind of leading the way. And this is kind of an intentional move away from past style characters, where you could have, say, autobiographical stories where you're thinking, you're just letting off every thought in your head, good or bad, but kind of being unassuming in action. This is kind of an intentional contrast.
I don't know how to set that up.
I'm trying to think how to even.
The question, I think, is characters, your recent characters have sort of an internal life.
As opposed to, like, earlier strips where it was just me spouting off. That was sort of a phase I went through, because to me, that it just seemed like it was a funny idea to just have yourself, sort of a fictitious version of yourself, saying these things that you didn't even necessarily agree with, just sort of having an opinionated character yelling at the reader. It sort of felt right at in 1990 somehow. It was like the world needed that, and now it's like the world is only that. You know, that's like the internet is that, basically. And so I feel like it's like a guy like Wilson is the exact kind of, he's sort of the opposite of that. You know, he's sort of a guy who, as you say, is living his own kind of small, sequestered, isolated life, and his opinions kind of seep into this public space, but it's not that same kind of opinionated diatribe that I was trying to get across in those stories. It's a very different thing.
And what are the plans for Mr. Wonderful? I know it's coming out in the spring, is it, or the summer?
It's coming out from Pantheon in next April.
Next April.
And it's quite a bit expanded.
Oh, it is? Okay.
It's some new comics and a lot of just... I wanted to kind of replicate the feel of reading that as a weekly strip. I always find weekly strip collections are very strange to read, you know, where you sort of, you realize there's a cliffhanger there, and yet then it just jumps right into the next page. And I tried to write that strip with cliffhangers every week for the seven people who were reading it in the magazine. And so I tried to figure out a way to sort of create some space in between each strip to give it a little bit of that feel of, you know, you're waiting a while to read the next strip. So I think it works.
One more question.
You gave us two different versions of Ghost World and Art School Confidential with the comic and the movie. Which version is more true to what you wanted to represent or what you want to get out there?
Oh, certainly the comics are my vision. I mean, that's me. Nobody reads my comics till I'm done. I mean, they're just literally, like, the printer is the first person to read what I've done. And so it's absolutely, there's no outside influence at all. And making a movie, every single decision is, like, even on an Ingmar Bergman movie, even like where a director is absolutely in control of everything, every decision is five people going, what color should the trigger on the gun be? You know, it's just, there's no way to have a truly personal vision in film that's not sort of filtered through a knowledge of the process of how to make film, which of course I did not have at all. And so I consider those sort of these fun alternative projects, but not anything that represents my 100% vision of the way something should be. The screenplay might be, but not the actual movie.
Okay, I think we'll probably we'll wrap it up. Thanks, Dan.